Our life insurance actually is evolving. Are the products that we design and sell today any better than the ones that we sold 25 years ago? We spend a lot of time thinking about the profitability of these products, the appropriate revenue recognition patterns, but are these products getting better at meeting the life insurance needs of the clients that we serve? In our day-to-day lives, we, knowingly or not, all use the actuarial control cycle. And an important part of this control cycle is monitoring the experience. Monitoring the experience allows us to feed back learnings and observations back into the respecification of the problem and the consequent solution. And this feedback loop enables refinement, development, and evolution. So today, I would like to invite all of you to self-reflect and to think about whether we, as actuaries, are progressing the way that we meet the life insurance needs of the clients that we serve. To help me do this, I have a somewhat provocative statement to pose and a panel of deeply thoughtful and mildly competitive debaters to argue whether that topic is true or not. that statement is true or not. So the statement that will be debated by the four gentlemen on stage is, as you can see on the screen, the design and implementation of new generation risk products demonstrate that actuaries have learned from the shortcomings in the design of universally costed life insurance products. The debaters have been split into two teams. So in the red corner, arguing that actuaries have learned from the past is Jason Lakey and Anthony Asher. And in the blue corner, arguing that actuaries have not learned from the past is David O'Brien and Andrew Warren. So just to quickly run through the structure of the debate so that you all can orientate yourself and know where you need to participate. Each participant will get 6 minutes to talk, and they will talk in an alternating order, so alternating between the two teams. There will then be there will then be 6 minutes available for questions. So given the short amount of time available, if you're asking a question in person, please be concise and to the point. There will then be 2 minutes for each team to consolidate their thoughts, close out their argument in an attempt to win your vote. There will then be 2 minutes for all of you to think about who you think won the debate. And then we will share the results and conclude. So before we get stuck into what I think is a very fun agenda, there are two things that I'd like to note. The first is that the views of the debaters put forward today are not their personal views, nor the views of the employer. They are just hypothetical arguments that one may make if they were to take the perspective that the debater has been asked to represent. The second point is that putting this debate together was a lot more difficult than I had originally anticipated. And the biggest challenge was to find willing participants. The general feedback from people was that there was discomfort with putting forward controversial views in a public forum like this, especially when the topic is so complex and nuanced. So I would like to appeal to everybody to please treat this session and potential future sessions like this with the necessary respect so that we can have difficult conversations, that we can ask controversial questions in the interest of learning, developing, and monitoring the experience. The last thing that I need to just mention is that in keeping with respecting this session, I've been asked to note that, or to ask that we treat this with, or we apply Chatham House rules, which apparently means that what happens in the house stays in the house. So without further rambling from me, Jason, are you ready?
Sweet, I'm going to be. Thanks, Yashita. Quickly, so on behalf of Team Red, while we are neither advocating that the design of new generation risk products are perfect in design, nor that the universal life products were completely flawed in design, we do believe that there are a number of lessons that have been learned by actuaries and that have been incorporated into the design of these newer products. So the first big lesson learned, we believe, is the length of premium guarantee periods. So as you know, many universal life products were sold with very long premium guarantee periods. We're talking about 20, 30 years plus, whereas the newer generation products are typically sold with a premium guarantee term typically of 5 years, maybe up to 10 years. Now think about it. You have 20 30-year guarantee periods where you're effectively guaranteeing a number of the assumptions underlying your premium basis or your guaranteed premium rate, and how things change over time, especially if you think of the 1980s, the economic environment in South Africa when these universal products were first sold, versus 2000s or the current economic environment with a low inflation environment which we transitioned into in South Africa. Then when you finally can review the premiums after 20 or 30 years, you now have to potentially at this very first review correct for 20 or 30 years divergence between what your expectations were and what actually happened in practice. And this can lead to some very large adjustments being required to ensure the sustainability of the product, either to the premiums or to the benefits. Also with universal life products by design, because you've got life, risk benefits and savings in one product, and the savings element is such an important integral part of the product, when you review premiums or you're trying to set risk premiums for the future, you also need to consider the past and how what investment returns and assumptions you achieved in setting that future premium rate. Whereas by design on new generation products, you typically only need to consider your future assumptions over the future period that you're guaranteeing the product. The second lesson learned, we believe, relates to the high underlying investment return assumptions that applied in some cases on many universal life products. So there were very many versions of these products that were sold, from the more expensive versions where customers had their premiums guaranteed for life, to the cheaper versions which required customers the policy to effectively earn 12, 15, sometimes 18% per annum over the whole life of the policy in order to sustain the premiums payable. These higher underlying investment return assumptions, which obviously made the premium cheaper for the customer, ultimately passed a lot of risk to the customer. And even if they knowingly accepted it, think about this, 20 or 30 years later, when there's now a requirement for premiums to be adjusted substantially or benefits adjusted substantially, we then need to consider all the considerations around affordability. The customer is now older, much closer to retirement, and then we've got our usual market conduct considerations, consideration of fair customer outcomes. New generation risk products are typically priced with more realistic investment return assumptions, and by design, the investment return assumption is not as important a factor as under universal because there is no savings element. The third, and we believe the most important lesson, relates to managing reasonable benefit expectations. With universal life products, you've got your life and savings benefits in one product, so you're trying to cover multiple needs with one solution. And while this may seem like a good idea on the surface to have a one-stop shop to meet all of these different needs for the customer, it does make it difficult to manage the different benefits. If you think of the life and savings benefits, how you manage the expectations over both of these as they potentially emerge over time and how they interplay with each other. Another issue that was very important was just around the often vague policy wording and the limited customer communication that often resulted, was associated with universal life products. Now, this is more related to the standards of disclosure that were applicable at the time, but they still played a very important part, especially as it related to wording around premium reviews. If you have unclear or irregular customer communication, it's very difficult to manage the expectations of the customer, whereas your new generation risk products are designed with more detailed and regular communication built into them. Now, here's a caveat here. A lot of this learning we cannot attribute strictly to the actuaries themselves. We were definitely helped along a lot by the regulators. As we know, there's a lot of regulators that's come through in recent years. We've had policyholder protection rules. We have market conduct considerations, TCF. So here I will just say is that the actuaries' learning were definitely helped along by the regulator. So as we see today in the new generation risk products, market conduct and TCF considerations permeate throughout the product design. As we have actually have realized, you can no longer strictly rely on your policy wording, especially if it's not very clear or if it gives you as the insurer or product provider lots of discretion. Products today need to be designed with market considerations and fair customer outcomes at the forefront and ensuring that any discretion is enforced appropriately. Ultimately, we are saying in many instances the universal life product concept just proved to be too complex for some customers to understand, especially in terms of how the risk and savings elements interplay with each other and how they're likely to progress over time. Hence, the move to the more modular approach in the South African market in terms of the separation of risk and savings benefits ultimately made it easier to manage customer expectations and also allows the customer to purchase the benefits that they really want instead of a package deal. Thank you.
Bit amateurs in the change over there. Sorry about that. Right. As Yashitan introduced, this is a debate for the purposes of, I suppose, entertainment. So you could consider the panelists to be actors. I personally identify as Brad Pitt. Some of you may see Brendan Gleeson, or heaven forbid, Morgan Freeman. But so please bear that in mind that this is personal views, particularly as I have some ex-colleagues in the audience. Right. So today, keeping with the theatrical theme, I am channeling the spirit of actuaries past, or the ghost of actuaries past, to demonstrate that actuaries have not learned very much. My partner in crime, Andrew, will channel different ghosts in the future and the present. Right. Start off. I need a piece of paper and a pen. Excuse me. Can anybody tell me what this is? Very good. This is an insurance administration platform from 100 years ago. Okay? And I think we forget that everything we do is a product of the time, and not all of it may be good as we move forward. According to Albert Einstein, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Although, as Abraham Lincoln said, don't believe everything that you read on the internet. Good, I'm glad people got that one. I cannot confirm that Einstein said that, but today I'm to demonstrate that the actuarial profession on that definition appears to be mad. Insurance is about risk transfer. It's generally transferred from a large balance sheet, or in the early days a group of people, away from an individual. Okay? As actuaries, our profession has grown up managing and governing that process. We need to remember that that's our role in the picture. So let's go into a brief history lesson. Edward Moore has established the Society for Equitable Assurances on Lives and Survivorship in 1762, world's first mutual insurer, and it introduced the framework for scientific insurance practice and development, which is basically the basis of modern life insurance. Moore's also gave the name to the profession. He called himself an actuary to the chief official, and that's the earliest known reference within a business concern. First modern actuary was William Morgan, who served 1775 to 1830, and this is the important point. In 1776, the Society carried out the first actuarial valuation of liabilities and subsequently distributed the first reversionary bonus and interim bonus among its members. The Society sought to treat its members equitably, and the directors tried to ensure that policyholders received a fair return on their investments. Right. I thought I would be speaking to a lot younger audience, but I assume they're all online. So the next point is... So take this as a compliment. Many of you are too young to remember bonuses as a method of allocating value to policies. But it is a very important concept. Policyholders paid a conservative price, the products were priced conservatively, the estate was managed conservatively, and then subsequently, if there was positive experience, it was shared back to the pool. So you didn't bother managing the risk to the discrete point, because actuaries can't do that, we're not crystal ball gazers. You rather took a broad brush approach and then allocated after the event. And I think that's a very important concept that we may have missed. It's also very practical when you're administering companies like this. But the premium and the benefits were certain to the beneficiaries, and that's an important point. I'm old enough to remember the first PC in an office. How sad is that? But actually, we yearn for those days. I think we've wasted technology on more busyness instead of more spare time. But before computers, as I said, it was sensible to make a rough calculation and distribute surplus later. As actuarial science developed, shareholders entered the industry because, hey, this thing is now becoming predictable, seeking a profit. It was common cause that Donny Gordon's company earned a better return for its shareholders than its customers. But obviously somebody has to pay for that. Shortly after after competition entered the market, or sorry, after profit you got competition. The original insurers were mutual societies. Call it the original TCF Pillar 2. The Scottish widows looked after the widows of clergymen. Ecclesiastical looked after the clergy themselves, and so on. You'll hear more about TCF from Andrew. The golden rule of models is do not change your assumptions to get the answer you want. We should have all learned that in Actuarial 101. But yet, that's exactly what the profession allowed to happen. So competition demanded that we offered a better proposition to customers in terms of a lower premium to acquire customers than the competition. So premium rates are relatively simple, as we all know. Mortality, lapse, expenses, and interest. So if you increase the interest rate assumption, then the premium decreases. So under pressure, actuaries increased, as you heard from Jason, increased the interest rates to excessively high levels. Then the CEO asked, wait a minute, if these assumptions aren't met, who pays the price? Oh, the shareholders do. Oh, well, that's not going to happen. So we have universal life born. Not quite true, but look, interactive. Hands up in the room who has an access bond. Hands up, hands up. Well, that's not very many. I was hoping to get more than that, but okay. An access bond is a universal debt. You have a fund, the loan, and you pay in extra, which means you pay less interest. That is a good concept. We all agree. Universal life is exactly the same idea. The fund is offsetting the risks I'm assured, and it's explicit. So the customer gets to see it as well. That was the logic. A good product. But if the interest rate is insufficient to start with, then the premium feeding the fund is never going to be good enough. And I think the other thing that we learnt as actuaries was, suddenly, the fund was public. Now, as we all know, there are expenses to set up a life policy, not least of which is distribution. You're kidding me. Okay. In summary, universal life is good and efficient. Masking the drivers of expenses is not good. Allowing salesmen to set that interest rate is not good. And the worst sin of all is not communicating what you have done to the customers. Thank you.
We can. All right. Okay. I am the ghost of Actuaries Past. I no longer can hear you guys, so it's now even more difficult to respond. So my first valuations as chief actuary of the old of the Prudential in 1982 were related to passing bonuses, and I faced the introduction of universal life in the 80s, and decided that I didn't want to change our conventional policies, that they could be made fixed by making our old policies more flexible. But what have we learnt from the change from universal life to the modern contracts that have been introduced in the last 20 years? Now, of course, a debate says the design and implementation of the new generation of risk products demonstrate that actuaries have learnt. How much? Well, all we want to say is something, rather than the opposition got answered that we've learnt nothing from shortfalls that are related to the design of the universally costed life insurance product. What Jason has demonstrated, in fact, is there were serious shortfalls in their design, not least because of the bundling with the investment component, which meant that commissions were higher and unnecessarily generous for investment policies. You had an investment policy and got nothing back in the first 2 years, didn't make sense. And then they made life more complicated later on. So what the first thing we've learned is that marketing involves meeting the needs of customers, and that if we unbundle our contracts, we can actually give we give more choice, it's a better deal, and from a competition point of view, unbundling means that there's more competition because a new company can come in and compete on the life insurance side, and new companies can come and compete on the investment side, which is what we've seen in South Africa, with the new companies actually taking a very large share of the new products. And that's good. That's great for that's good competition. So on marketing, we've learned that unbundling is a good idea. What we've learned in finance? Yeah. Donald Gordon's companies did earn a higher return for shareholders than for policyholders. But if I were to ask you, if any of you working for proprietary companies have a lower expectation of return for your shareholders than for your policyholders, or even an equal one, I'll be very surprised if any of you put your hands up. Sorry, I can't see you. So we've learned that shareholders require a greater cost of capital than the policyholders want their return, and the consequence is you shouldn't be investing shareholders' money and borrowing from the policyholders. And that's why the new products are much less capital intensive than the old. And that's precisely beneficial to the policyholders because they're not paying high rates of interest to the shareholders or high rates of return to the shareholders. So cost of capital means that it's highly unlikely that any guarantees that are given by the life insurers, even though they might appear to be good for marketing purposes, actually add value to the clients. You can say, in another way of looking at it, is that the cost of their life insurance is a diversifiable risk. It's very small in a lifetime. And really, to pay an insurance premium to get a guaranteed life premium is really not worth it. In terms of finance, we've learned that. Capital hungries and guarantees. In terms of administration, David, we did not use pen and paper in 1960. We had machines that we got 40 VITS students in for our evaluation in 1960, and they spent a week on fancy machines with cards and all sorts of things, and they did the evaluation in the same time as it took me 20 years later with a computer in the 1980s. And those machines actually go back to the 19th century. So, yeah, we knew what was going on, but it was complex. And we designed our reversionary bonus policies so that they were simple to administer. What happened with the universal life is because computers came along, we thought, we can do all sorts of fancy, flexible things. And so it introduced a huge amount of complexity, unnecessarily so, I think. And I think what we've learned on the administration side, that conceptual simplicity, separating out the investments and the life insurance, is a much better idea in terms for our purposes. And my final point would just be for the clients. We also learned something about the cash flow of people over their lifetimes. You do not want to be making savings in your 20s and 30s when you've got families and you're buying a house. You want to repay your mortgage, and then when you get to your 40s and 50s, you can save for retirement once the house is secure. All the modeling that I've done over many years is showing that's the case. And the new flexible products are perfect for that. So have actuaries learned? We're not hugely fast learners, but we have learned. And I do think that I think on balance, the new generation products are better than the old universal life. But I'm not sure they're internally much better than the previous reversionary bonuses. But that's because I am the ghost of actuaries past. Thank you.
So thank you, Anthony, and hi, everyone. So the design and implementation of new generation risk products demonstrate that actuaries have learned from the design of the shortfalls in design of universally costed insurance products. So Anthony is a great debater, put the nuanced view on have we learned or have we not learned. The question for me is, who made us learn, and what have we still got to learn? So as David introduced, he was looking at the spirit of the ghost of actuaries past. I'll be invoking the spirit of actuaries present to hopefully change the spirit of actuaries future. And in looking at this, I think we do need to look at the TCF principles that Jason's talked about of corporate culture, product design, clear information, suitable advice, product performance, and post-sales barriers. And I think it's clear to say that culture, meeting needs, and product performance is not up for debate, but I think there is debate for the other three in terms of the shift that we've made from universally costed products to new generation products. I also don't dispute that changes made have made things better in terms of certain elements of the universally costed product, in particularly clarity of information to clients and unreasonable post-sale barriers like early termination penalties. But if we look at those, the question we have to ask ourselves is, did the actuaries wag the dog, or did the dog wag the actuaries in terms of the TCF principles making us make those changes? Or were we driving those changes? And so when we look at the control cycle that Yashotin's talking about,
Are we driving the implementation through the lens of TCF, or are we constantly playing catch-up to an external regulator for which, as a professional, we should be leading? So if we look at two features particularly in the new generation products that I think demonstrate that we still have some learning to do, and we should get ahead of this curve rather than wait for someone to make us get ahead of the curve. One of those relates to the premium payment patterns. So in the chase for affordability and comparability, we were either made, if you take the view that the actuaries are a calculator on behalf of the shareholders, or we actively made the choice to go with the age-rated premium pattern. Now that seems to be fair for clients. They pay for the risk in the year that they that the shareholders are taking it, and clients can afford cover at inception. And we make the table of quotes for future escalations available for customers. So the client has the information they need. But we do need to ask, are the clients informed? Can they really appreciate the difference between an increasing premium 20, 30 years into the future versus what they can expect to earn from an income perspective? And in providing that table, are we giving the information to the advisors that is appropriate to the customer? Through this lens, I don't think we've fully learned. And what we've done is we've swapped a future projection of a fund value that was sitting in the universally costed product that turned into large telephone numbers under high interest rate environments to one where we now have a premium in the future that is incredibly unaffordable and not really understood by customers. And there may be consequences in the future when these premiums become unaffordable and policyholders can't retain the insurance cover that they believe they bought 10, 15 years in the past. And then the second aspect, where I think if we look at the design of the new generation risk products, is around the guarantee period that Jason talked about. But I look at it slightly differently. We transferred the mortality risk from the policyholder to the shareholder, but we weren't prepared to do it in its entirety. We left in place the 10-year guarantee points that are existing on existing products. And we're now getting to the point where we need to decide what to do with these reprice points. I want to look back at those universally costed products, where we have a look at particularly the low cover option, or at least the high cover options, where there were quite bold assumptions made about how the fund and its interest rates and the mortality increases would be supported by the contributions to the fund. And I remember debates early 2000s when insurers were busy grappling with the problem of having to go back to customers and say, the policies, and in our words, the policies have crashed. The guarantee period is over, the fund has been extinguished, and you now need to pay a lot more in subsequent years to try and keep the cover in place. And I remember the discussions with insurers and the debates had. In the new generation products, I've seen firsthand the debates that are happening to try and balance the interests of the policyholder and the shareholder in the space. And they're not easy discussions. What I will say is we've got much better governance in terms of how we look at that, and our policy committees that we have are providing a very good challenge against the shareholders. But we are sitting at a similar situation with the crash point, in which every year we're going to have to be trying to balance these very difficult trade-offs in a pricing environment and a new interest rate and lapse environment. And these are the legacies left to us by designers of product past. Under our new products, will we keep doing this year after year? Or is there another way to provide protection for both policyholders and shareholders with a different combination of product features? Are we actively looking at this before we're asked to look at it by the regulators? Our role as professionals, as Yashotin says, is we're always learning and adapting. If you agree with our counter-argument for the topic of the debate, I will leave it for actuaries of product present to leave a better legacy for actuaries of product future. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Okay, so we can now open the floor to questions, and I will just have a look online if there are any. Are there no questions? Okay, there's one in the chat. Lefras asks, how would the balancing of shareholder and policyholder needs affect our ability to implement learning from the past? Does it act as a barrier? So maybe Andrew and David, you can respond first, and then someone from Jason and Anthony.
So it was the balancing of shareholder versus policyholder.
How does the balance? How does the balancing of shareholder and policyholder needs affect our ability to implement learnings from the past? Does it act as a barrier?
The customer is always right, and shareholders generally like customers. So doing the right thing is never bad for shareholders. I think sometimes the market makes it difficult. It's difficult to do the right thing perpetually if someone else is not. But I think the shareholders should always look after customers.
Anthony or Jason, would you like to comment?
I think this one is up for debate. I think I agree with David there. And then I think also that we keep going back to regulations. I think that is the focus of a lot of the considerations that we see in the market, is to ensure that we get that balance right a bit more. And again, it's a helping hand, but the customer outcomes and customer fairness is obviously a big focus. We know that in our day-to-day job. So I think that is just a given at the moment for us, that we need to, in our companies across the areas, the actuaries who look after more of the shareholder interests, and the actuaries that look after the customer, that they find alignment. And obviously, ultimately, although we're in big corporations and we need to ensure that they remain profitable, there should definitely be equilibrium and probably a slight favor towards the customer.
There's a question somewhere. How do I...
How does anti-selection and the cost of anti-selection compare under the two products? So the past and the future product, past product and the current product. And maybe a second aspect to that is, has the sense of community amongst policyholders in sharing risk and paying for each other been lost? And is it everybody's out for themselves under the new product?
Can you just repeat for those of us online?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Okay, so how does, under the Universal Life product, the cost of anti-selection compare to that of the new product? And second addition to that question is, have policyholders lost their sense of sharing risk in community and sharing the risks of longevity and dying and all of those things? Or are everybody just out for themselves to get the best rate and get paid large benefits?
And Yashot and I have had debates around this. So I look at it slightly differently in terms of the new generation products around the lens of guaranteed insurability. So the anti-selection that is sitting, in my mind, in the new generation products relates to the fact that the selection is done by the healthy people who are able to exit their current product and enter a new product at preferential terms. The quotes that are taken up by those who don't get preferential terms 5 years into a contract are going to stay in the pool. So the natural situation is that the pool of risks in the new generation products will get worse over time as their product competition in the market is stronger. So you get your insurance, 5 years later you go and get another quote. If you are healthy and the market has improved, you will leave that risk pool. But if the market, if your health has deteriorated, you will stay in the pool because you won't be able to get a better rate in the market. So there are deteriorating risk pools in the product, which from a perspective of continuous improvement of rates for those in the pool is very difficult to maintain. So I do agree that what's happened is the individual underwriting and the individual move for best price for individual, which is different to what we sort of would have had in the past, is meaning that it's actually more difficult to not manage anti-selection at the exit point, rather than rather than what we would normally be looking at is anti-selection at the entry point.
Professor Asher, would you like to comment?
Can I come in here? Yes, Tan?
Yeah, would you like to comment?
Thank you. Yeah, so just quickly about shareholders. there has been a general tendency around the world for shareholders to be greedier than they used to be, and returns on capital have gone up, and the share of profits of the economy has gone up. Life insurance shareholders in South Africa have been pretty greedy from the middle of last century, so I wouldn't, not particularly concerned, not much of a change on that score. What we did lose in South Africa is the mutuals that added some sort of balance to that, and that needs to be addressed. But coming on to and I think that goes to the sharing idea of sharing risk. I think worldwide, people are less likely to buy into the idea of sharing risk than they used to. But I still, they will still do so. And so finally, the anti-selection question is clearly right. That there wasn't an anti-selection problem when you bundled investment and insurance together. And we forgot that. But we should have learned it from the buy term and invest the rest, because the US market has for many years had this problem of deteriorating risk pools. And we should have known that. Not, it's not covered by this debate. But we also could have learned from, there is a, I think a mutual, still a mutual shareholder, I won't mention the names because it's probably not allowed, who has a loyalty bonus attached, a loading on their risk premiums, and gives you a loyalty bonus, and that's the obvious solution. And we could have learned from that 20 years ago. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I don't think we have more time for questions. There's now 2 minutes for each team to close out their thoughts and try to win your vote.
Thanks. So our closing argument is that while universal life products were sold in a very different era to the new generation risk products, especially we think of the economic environment and just market conduct considerations, etc., we believe that there are definitely lessons that have been learned by actuaries in the design of these new products, as we've mentioned, specifically around the length of guarantee periods, the level of communication, the detail of the communication, as well as the level of investment return assumptions that were made. And these ultimately led to many universal life customers receiving outcomes which did not meet their expectations, whether those expectations be reasonable or not. The combined risk and savings benefit ultimately proved too complex for many of the customers, especially later on in the life of their policies when in many instances, the advisors who sold them the policy were no longer around to help provide advice on this more complex product. We believe that if these things had not been corrected for in new generation risk products, they would have created a lot of issues, and that the move to the more modular approach of separating risk and savings benefits, where customers could choose to purchase benefits which they needed at the various points of their life cycles, it ultimately helped customers it ultimately had a positive impact on them, as the bundling of benefits has been determined to be an unfair customer practice in many markets. Hence, we strongly believe that the lessons learned have been incorporated into the design and have been not only to the benefit of the customer, but also to the benefit of the product provider or insurance in many instances. For example, as Anthony mentioned, around the capital and financial management, because with Universal, where we had these long guarantee periods, the cost of guarantees had to be allowed for, and that made it difficult in many instances to justify to customers how exactly we costed for that guarantee. Thank you. Sorry, cut off there. Thanks.
We haven't learned. I get to do the second half of my speech. No. Okay, so this is a debate. Jason made the point about vague policy wording. We haven't learned. If anyone has recently bought an insurance policy, they are as vague today as they were previously. And in fact, when you add on the complexity of loyalty schemes that link to your gym time and whether the moon is in a solstice or not, then nobody knows what's going on. So we haven't learned. Jason also said that the regulators got involved, and Andrew spoke at length about that. If the regulators have to get involved, we have failed. It's somebody else telling us the mistakes we made. That same process, so TCF is about 10 years old. In the credit life space, about 5 years ago, the regulator also had to get involved. So again, we haven't learned as a profession. Anthony spoke about unbundling, it's better. The problem with unbundling is that your expenses are now spread twice on two products. So what happens is the minimum premium has risen. So now minimum premiums are inaccessible for people who want to get into unit trusts, whereas they used to get into a universal life plan at $100 a month. So that has problems. Jason and Anthony mentioned the capital issues. Again, IFRS has arrived. We'll hear a lot about that later, to help us manage capital issues. So again, external parties picking on us. Andrew spoke about the premium reviews. Premium reviews are coming. They will be as bad as universal life reviews, and they will be exacerbated by the loyalty schemes, because not only are the clients aging, but they're falling down the loyalty tiers, which mean the rate reviews will be even harder and heavier. And then they will drop out of the market or be very unhappy customers. and the anti-selection from the question on the floor, that will also be repriced in when the premiums are reviewed, because the shareholder will generally win. So my contention is that basically we haven't learnt. External parties are having to inform us, and I'm sure you'll vote that way when we get to vote. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody. Can we put this slide up that has the Mentimeter information? Okay. While the last votes are coming in, I just wanted to note that the results of the vote don't necessarily tell us whether we have learned or not. It just tells us who the audience thinks won the debate today. And the purpose of this debate was to stimulate thought within the profession, and to demonstrate how some experienced actuaries may grapple with some of these issues. So I'd like to thank the panel for putting themselves out there today, and to all of you for participating. And I hope that these thoughts and the issues that were raised today stay with you and become a part of the way that you think about your product development work. So far, there are 203 votes. And 133 of those votes was for David and Andrew arguing that actuaries have not learned from the past. And if anything, that means that there are discussions that need to be had back at the office. So I hope that those happen. Thank you all.